We'll call the House Tax Committee back to order. We do not quite have a quorum yet. When we do, we will take care of some administrative issues. But we have today, first House file 794. I would go to the other one, but the author has another bill up in another committee. So we'll go into House file 794 relating to public finance. Ms. Hani, if you and your counterpart there could please come to the table. So when we have a quorum, I'll officially move it. And again, members, we're not taking votes on these today, but we do want to hear these. And there will be an amendment. Oh, it's my amendment. Okay, when we, it'd be my intention when we have a quorum to put on the DE1 amendment, and I'll have somebody explain what that does. And then I believe there's another amendment. So please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Kathy Hani. I'm a lawyer at Fagree, Baker & Daniels. I'm here representing my client, the Minnesota Institute of Public Finance. The Institute of Public Finance, or MIPF as we kind of fondly call it, has been around since the early 80s. And you'll see that Chair Davids is the author of this bill. And by no means does that mean that Chair Davids loves every provision in this bill, because it's just long been the tradition that the chair of the House or the Senate Tax Committee has been kind enough to author our bills that we bring forward. Most years tends to be on an annual basis. The Institute of Public Finance is made up of bond councils, of financial advisors, municipal bond underwriters and bond traders, that generally their clients are public entities, the state or other local jurisdictions. And so these are the folks that try to help figure out whether it's local bond issues or other kinds of public finance projects, how to do it most efficiently, how to do it within the law, how to structure them, etc. Given last year there were so many new members on this committee, we did make the rounds and tried to meet with most of you that had any space on your calendars, just to talk about who we are and the kinds of things we do, and to again basically offer any counsel or advice or technical or otherwise in terms of public finance. And what we generally try to stay out of policy issues. We're really try to view ourselves as a resource in terms of how these things work, just because it can be a little bit complicated. I have Lynn Endorf with me, who is a bond counsel at Dorsey and Whitney, and he's the legislative chair of the Institute of Public Finance. And I'm certainly not the expert on this, but he is. So I'll turn it over to Lynn.
Okay, before we do that, I'll officially call the meeting of the House Tax Committee to order. We do have a quorum. Representative Coonan moves the minutes from March 6th. Any additions or corrections to those minutes? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Coonan. Okay, I will officially move House File 794 so that we have it before us. Mr. Michael, could you... the amendment? Okay, why don't we talk about the DE amendment first? It'd be in your packets the DE1 amendment to get the bill in the shape the author would like. But if did you want to describe it, Ms. Hani?
No, but if I could make just one comment on the DE1 amendment before I turn it over to Mr. Endorf. This is, Joel, correct me if I'm wrong, but this is a subset of the bill.
Mr. Michael,
I apologize. This is a subset of the bill as introduced last year. So to my knowledge, there is nothing new in the DE1 amendment that wasn't part of the original bill as introduced.
Mr. Michael?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, that is correct. There are a number of sections that were in the original bill that were dropped, and some of the sections that were in the original bill had provisions in them that were dropped. And so this is a narrower sort of grouping of provisions from the original bill.
Okay. If it's okay, members, why don't we get this on so we can talk about the bill as amended. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, members. Okay, please state your name and who you represent for the record. Please, sir, and if you could speak to House File 794 as amended.
Mr. Chairman, members, I'm Lynn Endorf. I'm an attorney with Dorsey & Whitney, but I'm here as the legislative chair for the Minnesota Institute of Public Finance.
Mr. Endorf, could you please spell your last name for the record?
E-N-D-O-R-F.
Thank you, sir. Please proceed.
Thank you. As Mr. Michael said, this is a pared-down version of the bill we introduced last year. We like to refer to it as our skinny bill. If it's okay with you, Mr. Chairman, and the members, I will proceed to go through this.
That'd be wonderful. Thank you, Mr. Endorf.
Section 1 of the bill relates to the energy improvements legislation referred to as PACE, that is, energy improvements to private property, that was passed a couple of years ago. We've noticed that there are a couple of problems in implementing that legislation that need to be addressed, one of which is addressed in Section 1. It refers to properties being benefited by the energy improvements. Now, benefit in Minnesota special assessment law implies that there's an increase in value of the property. That may or may not be true with these energy improvements. They may be beneficial to the property, but they may not benefit it in legal sense. So we've changed the language from can be benefited to may experience increased energy efficiency. If there are no questions on Section 1.
Section 1, Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have some real concerns about this. If the word benefit has a certain interpretation within a special assessment, so I don't have problems dealing with that, but I do have problems with the can be, which is an assurance that there has been an analysis and there is an expected benefit to the homeowner or the property owner in these energy improvements to may. And that takes it from a program in which there's credibility in terms of the energy assessment that's been done and the projections of potential benefits to the homeowner, whether that's increased value or not. The expectation is reduced energy utilization. And there's more than enough outfits out there that do good, credible work and who actually do credible environmental assessments of the kinds of energy improvements that any property owner can put in. But I don't think we need to loosen this up to maybe there's some benefit, because I think we really need to, if we're going to use this assessment for a unique need, and it's never been done before, as I understand it's a new use of assessments to pay for property improvements of this type, I think it should be stuff that's credibly done by an energy audit and is expected to have result in reduced energy utilization by the property owner. And this seems to me to loosen it up from a required that meant that it demonstrate a benefit, and maybe the word benefit is a challenge, as you've explained it, but instead it should be experience increased energy efficiency. And, you know, the may versus shall change is to me a significant expectation about these programs.
Mr. Endorf?
Mr. Chairman and Representative, it may very well have been a bad choice of words on my part. It was not my intent, nor the intent of the Institute to loosen it. I would have no problem changing may to will, for example, in that sentence.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Loeffler?
I'd like our counsel's suggestion on the wording, but I would like to have that retain the original legislative intent.
Mr. Michael?
Mr. Chairman, it's somewhat unusual to use the word will in the statutes, but I think in this case it conveys the intent that basically you're saying these are improvements to the property for the purpose of, you know, increasing energy efficiency. So I think that would be, I mean, the other thing you could do, could say that experiences increased energy. I mean, that would be another formulation either way.
But in the change, Mr. Michael, it says can be benefit. That's kind of a may. It can be.
Correct. Mr. Chairman, essentially, the thing that's under the special assessment law as it is now, that's a way of financing public improvements. So, for example, if you put curb and gutter or sidewalks in front of a property, you, in order for the government to involuntarily assess part or all of those costs against the property owner, there's a legal test that you have to have somebody with credibility ultimately to be looked at potentially by a court that says because the government put in those improvements, the value of the property went up as a result. With this program, it's an entirely different concept because the landowner, the property owner, is voluntarily deciding that this is a good way to finance improvements to their property, private improvements, as Mr. Endorf was saying. So here we're talking about putting in improvements to the building itself or something like that that will reduce, presumably, energy consumption based on the judgment of the property owner. And so while it's appropriate to have a mandatory benefits test for something that's done involuntarily, where you have the property owner making a decision, it's more like a choice or a market-based type decision. And so that's why I think they're asking for this sort of looser, more flexible test, so that just basically essentially saying, well, the purpose of this is to increase energy efficiency for the property. And how you capture that in language, you know, either by using will rather than may or saying that experiences, I think it, you know, it doesn't matter a great deal. But the special assessment law is intended to provide protection for the property owner when the local government is deciding to impose costs on them to pay for these public improvements.
Thank you, Mr. Michael. Representative Loeffler, then we'll go to Knuth and Erickson. Representative Loeffler?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. As I recall, when these were first being proposed, it was really, while it was an individual decision of the property owner, it was really more envisioned that it actually would be a governmental program, that a city could step up with a program of encouraging, say, small businesses to do energy improvements or homeowners of older homes to do energy improvements. And so, because I'm looking at it in terms of that as it's a government program with a government-sponsored financing mechanism, I think that we should have that energy audit expectation and, you know, have the assessment process when there has been some evidence that will experience. I like that.
Representative Knuth?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had a slightly different for language, but I'm fine with the will.
Okay. Representative Erickson?
Mr. Chair, and my question would be, before we make any changes, how is this measured, this energy efficiency? Because I've made lots of changes to my 50-year-old home, but because my rates keep increasing on my electricity, my energy efficiency is a wash. So, you know, how do you measure this? Because there are other factors that play in to result in actual, you know, savings.
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, the statute requires that you have either an energy audit or a feasibility study that would show that there are savings resulting from the efficiencies.
Well, Mr. Chair, just in response to that, yes, I've had audits done, but when my electrical rates have increased, then I've not had, you know, maybe I've had better movement of my heat in my home. But in the end, it has cost me more because my electric company has increased the rate. So, I'm just conflicted here.
Mr. Endorf, aren't we talking about efficiency in usage, not price?
Mr. Chairman, yes, that is correct. We're talking about usage. Here, the energy audits would show an efficiency in usage of energy. That doesn't necessarily mean that it will result in a lower cost, because the energy prices do vary.
Why don't, members, if it's okay, why don't we go through the rest of the bill? We will come back to, and Representative Loeffler, if you want to make an amendment when we get through the bill, we'll certainly entertain amendments once we've been through it. That's okay with members. Mr. Endor, please proceed.
Yes, Mr. Okay. Chairman. Section 2 of the bill also relates to the PACE Energy Improvement Program, and we are finding that the provision currently does not give us enough length of time for special assessments to pay for the cost of the improvements. And so we are suggesting that they can go up to 20 years for the special assessments for these energy projects. And also, if when you go down to Section 3, you'll see that we've made a corresponding change to, or addition to provide that the revenue bonds to be issued for these PACE improvements can go up to 20 years to match the assessment flow.
Okay.
Section 4 of the bill relates to county capital improvement program bonds. These are bonds that counties can issue for projects which have been put in their capital improvement program, which requires a public hearing. And also a public hearing is required on the bonds, and then there's a provision that allows for a reverse referendum petition on the issuance of the bond. We have had a number of our counties who have asked for some additional facilities to be added to the list of facilities that can be financed, and so we have added public works facilities, fairgrounds buildings, and facilities for record and data storage. And we've also added some language to this bill that would allow counties to, in effect, to cash flow their projects by adopting a resolution saying we intend to finance certain facilities before they have actually been entered into the capital improvement program, or the capital improvement plan. This would allow them to do construction financing, in effect, and then add the project to the capital plan and issue bonds for it when it's completed. Section 5 of the bill relates again to county capital improvement bonds, but you will see later on in the bill that we're making, that we're proposing to make corresponding changes to the capital improvement program law for cities, and also some of these changes would be proposed to be added to the municipal street reconstruction law, just to make those laws all consistent. The first is subdivision 2B of that law. We're proposing a change in the publication requirement, which is currently publication not less than 14 but more than 28 days, to not at least 10 but not more than 28, because these three provisions that I mentioned, the county CIP law, the city CIP law, and the street reconstruction law, even though they have similar procedures, have different publication requirements, which is confusing to people. So we're going to try to make them all consistent. And in lower down in Section C, this is the petition for reverse referendum provision. And it says that you have to have 5% of the votes cast, a petition equal to 5% of the votes cast in the county at the last general election. We're proposing to specify that that's the county general election. And we also, we're proposing to strike the provision about the Commissioner of Revenue preparing a suggested form of the question. As far as I know, the Commissioner of Revenue has never proposed a done a proposed form, and we've asked them about it, and they've not done anything to my knowledge about it. I would suggest you leave it to your local bond council to do that. We've added a provision that specifies there are two possibilities. One, that if a referendum petition is filed and it's found to be okay, the county can either just drop the project at that point, not submit it to an election. If they do that, we're proposing that they can't bring that project back for another run at it for a year. If they do submit the issuance of the bonds to a vote and the vote fails, then we would throw them over into the general provision on municipal bonds, which says that if an election fails, you can't resubmit the same project in the same amount for 180 days, and if it fails a second time, you can't resubmit it for a year. Section 6. We're proposing to add a provision. I think most of the members are familiar with the Build America bonds and other bonds that were taxable tax credit bonds that were issued in 2009 and 2010 under the stimulus bill. Some of those provide for federal subsidy payments to come back to municipalities on bonds that they issued during those periods of time. So we're proposing to add here a provision that says that in determining the ability to issue or the amount of bonds that can be issued under this provision, you're allowed to, which is tied to debt service on all of your debt, you're allowed to deduct the amount you're getting paid from the federal government.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And on that last provision, I have a question. I'm just trying to think that one through. So if you take the Obama stimulus bonds, and the way I understood the Build America bonds is they mostly flowed through counties as allocated to counties, that there was a certain amount that the Obama administration gave every county, and maybe I'm wrong on that. Maybe Mr. Michael can help me on that. And then some of the counties actually were pooling their authority, and I know like the Mall of America was getting money through this program by going to Hennepin County and saying, can we sort of use your allotment? Now, I might be confusing. I thought that was the Build America bonds, and that's one of the reasons the hotel is going up in Bloomington. And so I thought that, I understand you're saying, well, let us not count the subsidy back from the from the Congress against our debt limit. But I never thought it was a municipal count in the first place. I thought it was a county tracking, or is that not correct? Has it been weighed against cities like Bloomington right now, or I don't understand how it works.
Mr. Michael?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lincheski, I think you may be confusing a couple different federal programs that were part of the stimulus bill. The Build America bonds were just an option for tax-exempt bond issuers that applied across the board, basically, that allowed, well, let me back up. The easy way to understand it is normally when a municipality or a state entity issues bonds that are tax-exempt, and so they pay lower interest because the investors in those bonds do not pay tax on the interest that they receive. And so they're willing to accept a lower interest rate because they're tax-free. The Build America bond option that was given essentially, well, and the other thing to say about that is there's been over the years a lot of criticism about that because it's not the most cost-effective way for the federal government to provide a subsidy to municipal borrowers. And the reason it's not is because of the way those bonds are priced. There are some investors that get a bigger benefit because they're tax-free than others. You can imagine somebody who's in the 35% tax bracket gets a bigger benefit from having tax-free interest than somebody who's in the 28% bracket. So people in Congress or, you know, analysts have said, why don't you instead just pay a subsidy to the issuer? Because the whole goal is to lower the cost. And so the Build America bonds provided a second option where you could issue taxable bonds, and then the government, the federal government, would pay a subsidy back to the issuer for a portion of the interest cost. So that's how the savings would flow through. All this is doing is saying you can either get your lower interest because you issued tax-exempt bonds, or you can pay higher interest and then the federal government rebated part of the interest back to you. In any case, we want to measure how much you're paying on a net basis. So we're looking either with the tax-exempt bonds, it's just you paid lower interest to the investors. With the Build America bonds, you paid higher interest, but the federal government rebated some of that back to you. And what this bill is saying is we want to treat both instruments equally by looking at what your net payments were to judge where you are relative to your debt limit.
Okay. Representative Lencheski.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess so that the in the mall scenario with the Hennepin County allotment from the stimulus, that wasn't Build America bonds. That must have been some other kind of, you know, congressional promotion.
It may have been. They could issue them as Build America bonds, but that was a special stimulus program where there were allocations to the state. And probably Mr. Endorf is better able to.
Mr. Endorf?
Mr. Chairman Ripson Lencheski, I believe that the Mall of America was a separate program from the ones we're talking about here. And you're right, there were allocations from the federal government that were then went down to counties and eventually could be distributed to other entities. But that's not the type of bonds we're talking about here.
Thank you.
First Lencheski.
Thank you.
Okay, could you refresh us as to which section you're on, Mr. Endorf?
I am on Section 7. Of the bill, and Section 7 and 8 are related. This relates to the allocations for issuance of private activity bonds. The federal government allows the state of Minnesota, a certain allowance for issuance of private activity bonds by the state and its political subdivisions. That authority goes to the state, to MMB, and it's then allocated out in accordance with the provisions of Chapter 474A. This proposal we have in front of you here relates to what we refer to, or what are referred to in the statute, as public facilities projects. We refer to them in the bond area as exempt facility bonds because there is a list of types of facilities that can be financed, even though they are private activity, can be financed and still be federally tax exempt under the Internal Revenue Code. Among those are things like privately owned or operated or facilities for the benefit of private parties for water and sewer, solid waste, a number of those types of what we think of as public projects. So we're proposing, it has been a problem or a perceived problem in the in Minnesota trying to finance these privately owned water, solid waste, sewage projects, because our statute requires that to be financed, to receive an allocation, the facility has to be publicly owned. That is not a requirement of the federal tax exemption, but it is a requirement of our statute. which means that in order to finance this, even though it might, this facility might be a treatment facility, for example, for sewage, located adjacent to a private plant, provides a service that's beneficial to the community because it treats that plant's waste before it goes into the municipal treatment system. But it would have, it has to be publicly owned, and therefore municipality has to take title to it. They lease it back to the municipality, and this gets to be a problem and an expense. So we are proposing here to take out the publicly owned requirement. And just say it's a public facility project is any project that's defined as an exempt facility project for federal tax law.
Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And since the feds give us a capped allocation for these particular types of financing mechanisms, it seems to me that by the enacting the change that you're proposing, we're not giving any guidance as to how that capped allocation should be used. And by opening it up to privately owned facilities, we may be creating more demand for this that may make it more difficult. I mean, I understand the complexity of, you know, the example that you mentioned, but I think we still want to have most of this, actually, this limited allocation go to publicly owned projects. And can you tell us a little bit about how we divvy up our allocation? Is there a state agency that, you know, deals with that, or how does that work, and how might this change influence the uses or the competition for those limited resources?
Mr. Endor?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Loeffler, the Minnesota system is a fairly complex system of allocation. In general, the early part of the year, starting in January through, I believe it's August, the amount of allocation that's available for these public facilities projects, as the law is currently written, is quite limited. Almost half of that allocation is reserved for the Western Lake Superior Sanitary District. So in the early part of the year, there's a very limited ability to get allocation for these types of projects. In August, under our system, all of the, we have different pools for small issue manufacturing bonds, for housing bonds, for these public facilities bonds. In August, all of that's merged into a single pool. But at that point, these public facilities are not allowed to apply at all for allocation until October. And then in October, assuming there's allocation left, then the public facilities are allowed to apply without regard to any limitations for whatever remains in October.
Ms. Hani, the Loeffler question.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Loeffler, in addition, I did take that language and bring it to the attention of Assistant Commissioner Kristen Hansen at MMB, who said that she would like to circulate it among the various state agencies that use bond allocation and the various entitlement issuers and other interested parties. Now, that was just last week, but to this point, we have not heard back from them. But if we do hear back from them with any concerns, we will certainly either bring those to you or revisit this or whatever. So we have tried to let the stakeholders in the whole bond allocation system know about the language because, as you say, it is a finite universe and sometimes is contentious when you make changes there.
Representative Loeffler?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'd be glad to, before we finally act on this, you know, work with you and others on terms of some language, because I do think that the public benefit has to kind of lead, and given how tight the financial markets are right now, and the advantages of this financing, I could see all kinds of business expansions trying to creatively squeeze into this tiny pool, and I think we really want to honor that this is really to go to those projects that most benefit the public. And I'm not sure if we might be, in order to deal with a few limited circumstances, actually be creating more of a competition that's harder to mediate than we intended. So I think we need to think it through. But I appreciate your talking with others about that.
Thank you, Representative Lincheski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think Representative Loeffler hit it on the head. I mean, my concern on this would be if we have a capped amount of public ability and some of it's going to go private, then we just limit the amount of public we can do. And so, you know, these are tax benefits, and these private things will compete with the public things that are coming before us. So, Mr. Chair, as you put together, you know, a public finance article, I mean, I hope we'll have a further conversation about this and hear what MMB is saying, because we're already pretty tight as to what we can do. And then, you know, I couldn't find it in the bill, but the language in the summary calling, you know, qualified green building and sustainable design projects, geez, that's kind of everybody. I mean, I'm pretty sure lots of people could qualify, and I don't see where on the bill the language is defining that, but I just think of all the buildings just in my district that are LEED certified now, and who are private companies who could come in and compete for this. So, you know, I think we should have a longer, more robust conversation at a different time, maybe, to understand kind of what's going on in this provision. So, thank you.
Thank you, Representative Lincheski. Mr. Endor.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lincheski, the one thing I would point out is that we're not talking about here about competition between private facilities and truly public facilities, because the only facilities that need the allocation are those that have a primary benefit to a private entity. So we're talking here about you're correct that there is competition and maybe increased competition, but it is going to be increased competition between private uses. Between housing, small issue manufacturing, and public facilities. So we're, just to be perfectly clear, we're not talking about really truly public facilities. We're talking about facilities that are either of only of benefit to a private party or of primary benefit to a private party.
Ursula Lincheski.
Okay, thank you. That helps. I still think we should think about this a little bit, Mr. Chair, because the summary has a long list of what would qualify. And, you know, if members read it, I mean, it's airports and sewage facilities and green buildings and high-speed rail and hazardous waste facility. I just think we should think about it going forward. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Chesky. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just quickly, one of those items, mass commuting facilities, can you tell me what exactly that is?
Mr. Endor.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, mass commuting facilities are things like light rail transit North Star Line, I think, would qualify as a mass commuting facility if it were privately owned or operated. You might need that allocation for that type of facility.
Representative Anderson. Okay, please continue, Mr. Endorf. And we're still in Section 8, I believe.
I'm on Section 8, Mr. Chairman. The in Section 23A, Subdivision A, the list of the laundry list of facilities which can be financed with public facility bonds. That's was at one time a list that mirrored what the list of federal exempt facilities was. It no longer mirrors that list because there have been, over the years, a number of other facilities added to the list. So I have proposed here that we simply refer to the federal tax law so that we don't have to worry about our law being out of sync with the federal law. And similarly, at the end of that Section 8, the H paragraph there, enterprise zone facility bonds, I thought I would clean that up because it has a reference to the public law, which is quite old, and that's now been codified in the Internal Revenue Code, and it has been amended since the original public law was enacted. So that's just the cleanup. Section 9, this has to do with the city or municipal capital improvement program bonds, and this has that same language that I proposed for the counties that would allow them to cash flow a project, then include it in their capital improvement program when the construction is done and issue bonds at that time. That's what that additional language is all about in Section 9. Section 10 also applies to city capital improvement program bonds. Has many of the same provisions I talked about in the county capital improvement program bond issue, trying to make the period for publication of notice of hearing consistent at not less than 10, but nor more than 28 days, so that all of the provisions are the same. Making it clear that the petition has to be by 5% of the votes cast in the municipality in the last municipal general election. Again, getting rid of the commissioner shall prepare a suggested form of question. And then also the same language about what happens if the municipality receives a petition and decides either not to have an election or has an election and the election fails. Section 11. This is that provision that we talked about with the Build America bonds and allowing a deduct when you're determining how many bonds can be issued, where this is based on your debt service of the bonds to be issued, that you can deduct the federal subsidy that you're receiving on your Build America bonds. Section 12. These are provisions generally to make the municipal street reconstruction bond law consistent with the changes proposed for the CIP laws for counties and municipalities. This law already has the 10, not less than 10, nor more than 28-day provision. We've made the others consistent with that. We have the same provision about what happens if you get a petition for referendum and you either don't have an election or you have an election that fails. And finally, you have the provision that allows them cash flow during construction and then bond for it later. And that is the end of the amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Endorf. Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Endorf, a couple questions. You wanted to bring continuity to the number of days in the public notice. Why did you choose to decrease to 10 instead of increasing to 14 to bring consistency?
Mr. Endorf.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, we could have gone the other way. However, many of our other provisions, improvement bonds, for example, has a provision that requires two publications, the second of which has to be 10 days. 10 days seems to go throughout a number of the provisions. So we thought that 10 days was a sufficient amount of notice for public hearing. and we went that way. We could have gone the other way.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Endorf, I prefer the 14-day approach, but Mr. Endorf, I know Representative Runbeck has a bill, and I've talked to her about it quite a bit, and there is a growing trend, or maybe it's always been there, but certainly one that's been observed quite more regularly now, where municipalities are doing end around on the capital improvement project process and actually using lease bonding authority through their HRA or their EDAs in order to skirt around the voters. And this is something that's problematic, and the Representative Runbeck is addressing it with a different bill that she's got. I just wonder, this bill generally seems to move away from that spirit of having the integrity in the face of the voters, and I would hope that as the bill moves forward, it could not move in that direction. I'm curious also about the desire to be able to have the which was a section here. Section 4 on page 2.25 to be able to use those to actually be able to have approval of the dollars before the project is completed. What's the rationale there? What's the discussion there? If you could expound on that a little bit.
Mr. Andor.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Drazkowski, I think the concern is that it is sometimes a benefit to the municipality, assuming that they have sufficient cash on hand temporarily to finance a project during construction. To do so rather than to put the project in the capital improvement plan and issue bonds at the outset, particularly in today's economic market, where the ability, if you issue bonds at the outset of the project, you have to put those, you get the bond proceeds, you have to put them in some investment and then parcel them out as construction progresses. In today's, actually in the last few years, because of the limited amount you can earn, a very small amount you can earn on those deposits of bond proceeds, municipalities have been looking for ways to use cash that's temporarily available, but not available on a long-term basis, but temporarily available, to reduce that the cost, because otherwise they're paying, during construction, they're paying 3 or 4% on their bonds and getting, you know, 0.75% on their investments. That's the primary reason for wanting to do this.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In that, at least the example that I'm aware of, where we had a county government build a jail that was not supported by the people in the county, and the county government did an end around on the people, and it was certainly not a pretty thing. In that situation, as I observed and saw that, I did see that when they got to the point of talking about financing, the project had not even had a capital improvement plan at that point. And so, you know, I don't know if it was a design for them to go around that process to begin with. Could you just quickly outline how that process works? I'm trying to remember exactly how it works. There's a couple of different options you mentioned there as the municipality brings the project forward. As this ties to the rest of the statute, that would be helpful.
Mr. Andor?
Mr. Chairman and Representative, the normally, if we are talking about the normal capital improvement program process, you have a capital improvement plan, a five-year plan, and that plan is brought to a public hearing, and if there are items in that plan which are going to be financed with capital improvement program bonds, you have a public hearing on the issuance of those bonds, probably at the same time that you have the plan hearing. What we're talking about here is the municipality would have some kind of a resolution, which we would call a reimbursement resolution, that says that we intend to finance a project, describing the project and its estimated cost, and that we intend to include it in our capital improvement program plan at some point and issue bonds for it.
Representative Raskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Endorf, so it sounds like the process and the municipality are being somewhat presumptuous to the will of the people and their in the public participation in that process if we head in this direction. That's what I'm seeing as problematic here. I don't know if you have any comments on that, but thank you.
Mr. Endorf?
I guess I can't comment on that. I think the municipality proceeds in that regard. I think proceeds at some risk that they are not going to be able that the money they have invested in that project, the cash they've invested in that project, is going to be is not going to become available to them later if they can't get the project approved.
Okay, thank you. Members, I think what we'll do is, I know we've got a Loeffler potential amendment here. I think there's a couple others. Before we go on, we do have folks that have traveled in for the Masrall bill. So on this bill, House File 794, is there anyone else that would wish to testify? We'll have some questions here. Is there anyone else that wishes to, is the department have any comments or on this bill? Or okay. From the department. Please state your name for the record.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members. Susan Von Musch with the Department of Revenue. The only part of the bill that affects us directly is subdivision 5 and 10, I believe it is, that deals with the fact that we were charged with describing the ballot questions as it related to some of the language for bonds, and we are okay with that coming out because the Department of Revenue really doesn't have any authority generally for bonding issues, and so that's really the only part that affects us, and that would be our only comment.
Okay, any questions for Ms. Von Musch? Okay, to the bill itself, Representative Lencheski.
Well, a couple things, Mr. Chair. One is, we were told there would be no votes today, and now you're talking about taking amendments, so I you know, is that not true? So.
Well, okay, we will take a look at some of the amendments here, and then this bill will be coming back.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I just asked because I'm certainly thinking of a couple myself, and I assumed it would happen in the omnibus tax bill that we would amend the public finance article. So, okay. You know, I would hope we could get some time to get folks here if we're going to take some votes on some amendments.
Right, and so what we're looking at now is Representative Loeffler will be, I think what I'm going to do, though, since we have folks in here from the Masrall bill, I'll be laying House File 794 as amended. We did do the DE1 amendment to get the bill in the shape the author wanted.
Right.
Representative Loeffler, and I think there's some other, Representative Loon, you have a potential amendment here. I think that's what we'll do. Representative Lencheski.
Well, and on that, Mr. Chair, I mean, you know, I would want to think through a lot of what we just heard. I have some of the concerns Representative Draskowski just talked about, a little different. I think he was talking about having your Port Authority or HRA or somebody else go and do bonding if it doesn't work over here. But one of the concerns that I have not figured out in Section 5, there's these two provisions, and I don't think going from 10 days to 14 or 14 to 10 is a big deal. But these provisions about we're going to now go from the general state 5% of the electorate for a reverse referendum to a county general, you know, I'd want to know how many counties means that's a significantly smaller bar to get over. Because if it's 5% of a general election for a county board seat, that could be the petitioning process is bigger or smaller. And so I don't know the effect of that provision. We just heard it here and now. So that I think that has a concern. But then also similarly in the bill, there's a provision that to me is I haven't thought that one through either, that it's like, okay, so if the people of, you know, Representative Drazkowski's area petition and say, we don't want this bonding thing, we're going to take it to the election now, and we've got the signatures, that now the group, the county, can drop the idea, like, okay, maybe we think it's going to fail, so now we're going to drop it, and we'll just agree to not take it up for a year. And I haven't figured out how that works either, so, I mean, I think, you know, this is something we just need to hear more from even the counties, how they're going to view this. And I think we'd be fairly divided on bipartisanly on reverse referendums and that kind of question. But there is a concern, Ms. Von Mosch, in that one line that seems pretty simple. You know, I get that the Department of Revenue would not want to prepare the ballot question. But this committee has had huge battles on that issue as it relates to school bonds. And so I think Representative Dabney can tell you, and he and I have disagreed on this. He's thought that we should allow, I think, and maybe he'll correct me if I'm wrong, that we'll let the school boards write the question on, you know, if you pass this bond, it's not a new tax increase, it's just an ongoing tax. The language on the ballot question, and there's been times in the past the Education Committee has tried to write that. And we've pulled it into taxes and said, no, it is a revenue question. How you word the ballot question matters. So I think what happened in the end is we've sort of said, let's let the Department of Revenue, let's let the tax world write the question. But this comes up, we're talking about in counties now, but in schools it's a big question because in the past, you know, some school advocates have been very creative in how they ask a ballot question for new debt that implies to people like, you know, this is really kind of nothing, just approve it. And, you know, people like me, I think more along with Representative Drazkowski than Dabney, quite honestly, like to see it kind of squarely defined. And so some of the compromise on this is sort of who writes the questions when you describe these bond things. And I do think it matters, and I would hope we wouldn't just hurry through it today without thinking through all the changes that are being mentioned in this bill.
Thank you, Representative Lincheski. And I'd like to lay this over, unless Representative Dabney, briefly.
Very briefly, Mr. Chair. If my memory serves, the question that you're discussing, Representative Lincheski, was about excess levies, not bonds.
That could be.
And it was the scenario was if a school board was going out to continue an expiring levy at the same level, did they have to identify it as a new tax when you could argue that it was not, it was a continuation of an existing levy? So it was the ballot language in that scenario.
Briefly,
Representative. Mr. Chair, I know you're trying to move on, and I think that's right. It maybe was a levy, but that just highlights the issue right there, right? I mean, if it, this bill's about bonding, but you can see how, depending on who's writing the description on the ballot, it's a very different sort of voting behavior that takes place. So I think we have to care about it.
And as long as we're going down memory lane, maybe Mr. Michael could look into this. And who was the first mayor in the state to use the lease purchase law? And to skirt the will of the voters?
Was it you?
I think it was me. We'll have to look that one up. 1989. Before I was in the legislature.
Yeah, okay. David's all over again.
With that being said, we will lay over House File 794, and the advice of Representative Lincheski and others is very well taken, that some of these things that look a little not controversial, whatever, could create some discussion. So, and a message to the counties and cities, you may want to weigh in on some of this as to, you know, how this might operate for you. And we'll want to hear from the department, of course, also. Okay, so we'll lay that over. Representative Mazeroff, welcome to the Tax Committee. I will move House File 2429, and the motion at the end of the discussion will be to lay over possible inclusion in omnibus tax. So we will not be voting on this bill today. So, Representative Mazeroff, welcome to the Tax Committee. And again, members, I move House File 2429. Representative Mazeroff, if you could please present your bill to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. House File 2429 is designed to assist emerging technology and biotechnology companies to transfer their unused Minnesota net operating loss carryforwards for cash. Profitable companies that are now paying a Minnesota corporate tax can then buy those credits at a discount and reduce their own state tax obligation. This program has been tried elsewhere, and it provides early-stage companies with infusions of operating capital to accelerate their path to profitability without having to seek additional debt or equity financing. It also allows the larger companies to fund these early-stage companies with that cash and themselves receive the net operating loss tax credit. I have with me Mr. Shea Mandel, who is Vice President of Government Affairs for Life Science Alley, to testify on this bill.
Thank you, Representative Mazzaroff. First of all, before we go on the testimony, is there anyone else that would like to testify on behalf of this bill or with concerns? Okay, please state your name. If you could spell your last name, sir.
Sure. Mr. Chairman, my name is Shea Mandel, last name M-A-N-D-L-E, and I am Vice President for Government Relations at Life Science Alley. And for those of you who aren't aware of Life Science Alley, we are actually the largest state-based life sciences organization in the nation. Here in Minnesota, we have 680 member companies and organizations, which include research organizations such as the University of Minnesota and Mayo. Our member companies and organizations employ just over a quarter of a million people here in Minnesota. And the bill that we've been working on, and I want to appreciate and thank Representative Mazzaroff for his leadership and willingness to come speak on our behalf, is really about making sure that Minnesota's competitiveness in an area that is unique to our state continues to grow and prosper. What we're proposing in this bill is to take a unique subset of companies. And when I say unique, I don't mean better than other industries, but unique to Minnesota. So what we're talking about are companies not that fit into the angel investor tax credit package, really small companies, and we're certainly not talking about our large companies that are profitable in Minnesota. What we're talking about are those companies that are working on a device or a therapeutic that, because of the nature of the regulatory environment, the requirement for clinical studies, and the R&D required, take a long time to move to profitability. Effectively, these companies are set up with the intention of losing large amounts of money for a period of time, 3, 4, 5 years. So investors make investments in companies that need to go through this process. One of the issues we have is, no surprise, the environment continues to change. So if I were a CEO working on a next-generation cancer therapy and had sat down with a group of investors and raised $100 million around a 4 or 5 year business plan that I thought was going to be able to get our product to market, that might have been great 3 years ago. But then the FDA wanted additional aspects to a clinical study that we hadn't counted on, or we got a delay in one aspect of our FDA approval, or the cost of some of our equipment have gone up. And now I'm going back to my investors and saying, in order for us to get there, we're so close, but in order for us to get there and grow, we really need to bring some more dollars in. What this allows those companies to do is to take their losses, and what we want them to do is become profitable, because once they do, then they're paying income taxes here in Minnesota. So we allow them to take those losses, count them as tax credits today, get the dollars for them, and those dollars in these companies, and we're talking about companies with, again, 50, 75 people, high-value, high-wage jobs working on therapeutics and devices, those companies get an infusion of capital, not tied to debt, which is difficult to do today, not tied to equity, which is increasingly a challenge, direct dollars that they can invest to improve their current state. Two more regulatory people, another couple of scientists to resolve those clinical issues. And by surrendering those operating loss credits, as these companies become profitable, the state of Minnesota begins to pull in revenue from those companies immediately, as opposed to 2, 3, 4 years downstream as they're writing off the losses that they're naturally taking. So we think this is a great opportunity for the state to immediately create jobs. We are sure this is a a great opportunity for the state long-term to keep our unique talent pool here and continue to attract the kind of talent that doesn't exist in most other places here to the Twin Cities. Touches biotech, pharma, med tech. So on behalf of Life Science Alley, and again, our 250,000 employees here in the state of Minnesota, I submit to you this bill and hope that I can answer any questions that you might have about it. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, Mr. Mandel, we will go into questions, so if you could stay there, but I'd like to bring Ms. Templin down or to the table first just to go over the revenue note here. And then we'll go into questions for Ms. Templin and then to Mr. Mandel and the author. Please state your name and who represents for the record, please.
Mr. Chair, Cynthia Templin, House Fiscal Staff. You should have members a revenue estimate for House Bill 2429, the first engrossment. just to summarize the revenue impacts pretty quickly, there is a capped allocation for these unused NOL deductions each year that amounts to, or that equals $60 million in fiscal 13. It's $60 million each year through fiscal, well, ongoing. It starts in tax year 12, and let me think what else. The fiscal effect of the activity in the tax year reduces the collections in the following fiscal year. So even though the bill is effective for tax year 12, the first year of fiscal impact is in fiscal 13.
And members, just so you know, I have absolutely no way to pay for this at this point. This is for a discussion.
Appreciate that.
To take a look at, and of course, those numbers will be adjusted up or down or in between. So there's no way to pay for it at this point, but we are gathering ideas as a tax committee right now. Representative Marquardt.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Mandel, I know it's been talked that this has been, I don't know if we can move that chair.
Excuse me, any questions for Ms. Templin first?
No,
we'll
sorry,
go
I don't.
Right to Mr. Mandel and Representative Marquardt. Okay.
Thank you.
Representative Marquardt.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I know one of the states that has used this is New Jersey. Mm-hmm. And the New Jersey Institute of Technology did a report and said that this program was very effective for the biotechs. Mm-hmm. In fact, they saw some really dramatic increase in jobs. But it said other tech companies actually saw, kind of over the time of the study, I think it was 2000 to 2004, that jobs in other tech areas had gone down. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't see where the study said why that was. Would you have any reason why it would be really good for the biotech, young biotechs, but not for other
sure.
tech companies?
Sorry, Mr. Chairman. Happy to answer that question, Representative. The you know, part of the other techs going down, I mean, is, you know, I think what we all recognize is a product of both globalization and our economic situation. So the technology industry, in particular in New Jersey, which has had some significant business issues over the past few years, there's no...
Thanks for having Lash.
Yeah, of course.
So to continue answering the question, so the explanation for decreases in other technologies, you know, there's no evidence to suggest that it has any connection to this bill at all, but rather, you know, I think as a product of probably, you know, sort of movements in other technology industries away from New Jersey, which has happened over the years. One of the reasons this works for biotech, and again, I think that, you know, I don't think we would be here to advocate on behalf of a tax policy change like this to target any industry. Pharmaceutical companies, which is predominantly what is in New Jersey, and they right. classify that right. as biotech, are biologics, pharma, and med device companies here, you know, all have one unique challenge. They have lots of business challenges that all businesses face. There may be other challenges that other industries face that our biotech companies don't. But you've got to prove exactly what your pharmaceutical and your device will do. Very complex clinical trials. Very complex and currently very uncertain regulatory pathways within the FDA. Needing to get those marks in other nations as well to be able to sell. So the process of getting a product to market in the medical technology space simply takes a lot of time and a lot of money. And so this is a way to suggest to those companies that the state wants those companies to be in our state, that we recognize that those are exactly the kind of jobs and the kind of talent pool that will keep our state economy strong and allow us to weather you know, other fluxes in the marketplace. But no, New Jersey, which is the only other state, representative, as you know, that has played around with this concept, has had a lot of success. And in 2009, they put $34 million in credits out, which helped bring, you know, another more than $500 million of investment and activity into their pharma companies. And the connection between what this bill will not hurt at all any other technology industries, which I think is the core of your question.
Representative Marquardt?
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Mandel. I appreciate that. And, you know, I do think biotech is one area where, you know, Minnesota really needs to, you know, we've got great potential there. And anything that might work in that area is super. There's one part of the bill on Subdivision 5, and I don't know, I think when Mr. Mandel's here, it kind of refers to that. It's the recapture of tax benefits. And the reason I ask this question is in the literature, it talks about that there's an increasing trend right now of life sciences companies to outsource to cheaper locations, like countries like India and so forth. And so I know in Subdivision 5, we're trying to kind of get to that point. You know, if you look at lines 5.6 through 5.10, it talks about if it fails, maintain headquarters or a base of operations. But what I'm concerned about is that once jobs are created, or that this new technology produces new products, how can we assure that that product is not going to be manufactured elsewhere, or jobs are, you know, once it's developed here in Minnesota based upon these state dollars that were given to the program, are there any assurances here that those new products and those new jobs created can't be outsourced, either out of state or out of country, to another area? And I don't know if Subdivision 5, I'd feel a lot more comfortable if there was a little more stringent than just saying that they have headquarters and so forth. It doesn't seem to address that concern. I'd like your comments on that, if I could.
Mr. Mandel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Would love to address it, because this is the question that always comes up, and I think the answers are really important. So, first of all, the organization, the companies that we're targeting here, Representative, are companies that are currently headquartered. And because of their size and because they don't have a product in the marketplace yet, these companies are in one location. They're here, right? That's the companies we're targeting. So imagine 50 scientists and, you know, business development regulatory people in an office in Plymouth or in Woodbury doing, you know, with $80 million of investment and trying to get through the FDA process. There's no question that as a company grows, so as these companies become profitable and someday become big public companies, right, so the next 3M or Medtronic emerges, one, they will do business all around the world. Two, because of the nature, as you know, of med devices and pharma, you know, most countries have country of origin restrictions that require companies to have some base of operations, to do some manufacturing in certain countries, to be able to sell those products and get through their regulatory process and get a mark. So as our companies grow to become big public companies, you know, I think we should celebrate the fact that they'll be able to put their products into people's hands around the world, and that will require them to set up different aspects of operation. What this is core to is making sure that these middle-of-the-road companies that aren't worried about outsourcing, and by the way, outsourcing in this field is really just about, again, being able to manufacture in countries to deal with some of those regulations. Today, the core intellectual foundation, the R&D, happens here. And what this bill speaks to is really trying to make sure that that never goes away, that we're keeping that core talent of scientists, engineers, and the creators of the next generation of therapies here, because that isn't being outsourced today. And so this gets companies that have all their core scientific people here, and as they grow, that keeps their operations here, also allows them to branch out, do business around the world, but we keep that core R&D hard science talent that nobody else can no one else can replicate that. So that is what the core of this bill really does, is make sure that 10 and 15 and 20 years from now, we're still having this conversation as opposed to the core of this industry being in China or being in Malaysia, both of whom would like to have.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one final comment. I appreciate that. I'm just, you know, looking at the return on investment. So, you know, if we put $1 million into a business, that the state gets that before, you know, so we're not just a training ground for, you know, they go elsewhere. But I appreciate those comments. Thank you, Mr.
Well,
Chair.
Well, thank you, Representative Mark Cardin. And you bring up a very good point. I'm too concerned about, you know, the New Jersey situation. And I haven't talked to the author about this, but maybe we need to tighten it down a little bit from just technical as a broad category more to the biotech, since that seems where we're trying to head here. So, and I haven't talked to Representative Mazrell, as I mentioned. So, okay, Representative Lencheski and then Downey. Representative Lencheski.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Mazrell and Mr. was it Mandel? I just thinking about this, and it probably would surprise no one on this committee, I don't think this is a good idea. Not a fan of tax credits or business subsidies, but that's neither here nor there, because this chair and this majority will decide if they want to use our limited resources to give this industry another subsidy. But, you know, Mr. Chair, you know, I hope you all in the majority will think about, you know, whether it's this one or Capco or more R&D or Angel, or I mean, these are all just another way to, you know, subsidize business under the guise of jobs, and we're all for that. You know, why not just give $60 million a year to the U of M? I mean, you know, I think you should think about, if you're really trying to get this industry going, the real, you know, percolator is the U of M. And so I just want you to think about this as, again, a chair who wants you to spend your money to buy them something. So that's what tax credits really do, is they just hide spending in the tax code. So if the higher ed chair thinks we need to incent biotech, he should use $60 million out of his target to pay for it. Or if the bonding chair should, or whatever. I mean, all these tax credits serve to take funding, you know, whether it's an education credit or an ag credit or this credit, that makes the tax committee have to either cut more stuff in the tax code or raise taxes, and I'm certain you're not going to do that, but you're going to have to cut something else so that these other finance chairs don't have to pay for these ideas. You know, they can do them all through grants. They can put the money into the U, and, you know, I hope you will go to the speaker and say, make all those other finance chairs pay for their own stuff. I get why people like these ideas, and there's no disrespect to the author and the person who's here, but, you know, think about this one a little bit. It's just allowing, if I understand it, a company that's losing money to sell its losses to someone who's making money. So that sounds pretty good, except for the fact that the company that's losing money, who's now selling its losses to the company that's making money, gets to not pay as much in taxes, so we have to pay for it. That's why there's a price tag to it. So it changes the revenue complexion for the state of Minnesota, so you have to go find $60 million to do it. So, I mean, I understand with biotech and hearing people talk about, you know, cancer, it's very attractive, but think about it this way. What if we had this same program for every startup restaurant? Because I think in that industry, about 4 out of 5 close in a couple of years, because it's really hard to get successful. It takes a while. So what we'll do is we'll let them sell their losses rather than go out of business, which is what capitalism is supposed to be all about. I mean, it's not about picking winners and losers. It's letting the market work, and that means a lot of people fail. And we all benefit as consumers in capitalism because we get better things at lower prices when the people who are bad at it fail and the people who are good at it do it cheaper. So let's let capitalism work. But if we did this for restaurants, then they would sell their losses to, you know, I don't know if it'd be agribusiness or General Mills or someone who's making money at producing food, or maybe they'd sell it to McDonald's or Starbucks. And so Starbucks would write off their loss for this restaurant so they can kind of keep afloat for a while, and Starbucks pays less in taxes. Or we could do it in the computer industry. We could have all the new startup small computing businesses sell their losses to IBM. And so they keep going for a while, and then IBM pays less taxes. You know, or we could do it in clothing. We could have all the startup, you know, people who are selling clothing sell their tax credits to Macy's and Nordstrom's and Target. And so, I mean, you know, why pick this industry? And I guess the argument, well, these are high-paying jobs that take a lot of time to develop products, and they take high educations. And I don't think anyone disagrees with that. But, I mean, this is counter, as are all these programs, counter to capitalism. Obviously, you know, people like to believe that we're not picking winners and losers in these bills, but that's exactly what they're doing. It's saying in our limited $35 billion, we're going to carve out $60 million for this industry. That's what it's doing. And, Mr. Chair, I just hope you'll think holistically. You're doing, you know, you're hearing all the bills, and that's great. But I hope you'll think long and hard about whose job it really is in this legislature if we're going to have these business subsidies to find all the money for it. And I would argue it's definitely not you. And so if you go down the road with any of this, then you get to cut something else. And I don't support these concepts. I respect the author. I respect this gentleman here who's working for Life Science Alley. But it's much bigger than just selling a little loss so that we can have a really good, you know, physicist be here and make a product for Medtronic. And you start going down this road of more tax expenditures, every industry is going to be in here with the next kind of bill the next year. So, thank you.
Well, they're already here.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you, Representative Lincheski. Representative Downey, and then Erickson. Representative Downey.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I would disagree with Representative Lincheski in terms of I think there's a substantial difference between a targeted tax credit. We'd all love to do a generalized reduction in pass-through income tax rates or corporate income tax rates. We can't, so we're left with reducing tax burdens in selective areas, and granted there's some policy dimensions to that and people kind of fighting for space to get those selective tax relief items. But I think this bill is, and this program is a little different, and I don't think it fits even what Representative Lincheski was talking about. It's I think just substantively a very different thing, because what we're creating is a state-run market or a state-run exchange for people to buy and sell operating losses. And so we kind of have the, instead of the Chicago Mercantile, we got the Minnesota Mercantile where we're selling corporate losses. And we do that, I think, in a fairly blind way. And I know I've had a chance to talk with the author, and I appreciate the creativity and the energy he's bringing to his organization. But I think we got to look at it from that perspective. And I look at this, and the author and Mr. Mandel can critique my comments here if I'm wrong or if the bill is written differently. But somebody could actually incur losses literally for up to 15 years or have a business plan that shows that they're going to have losses for the next 15 years and sell those losses and somehow find a way to stay in business. And so this concept from Mr. Mandel that we're so close to being profitable, I don't think there's any control on that in the bill. I don't think there's any requirement for a business plan. We have no idea whether the person selling the losses is just at the last final year of their burn rate, and so now they're going to pay for their salaries and their operations for another year before going out of business and just delay the inevitable by a year and you know, keep themselves kind of afloat for a while. So I don't see anything that controls for that. And I think what we're unintentionally doing is we're actually attracting money to the least successful ventures out there. So in other words, if you can't envision any scenario where you would become profitable enough to actually use your losses, that's the point at which you'd be incentivized to participate in this new market that we create. And the purchaser doesn't care. The purchaser is just getting a 75%, you know, credit on their acquisition of this loss, and so it's just money for them. It's really blind. The purchaser has no interest in the success of the company, doesn't know whether they're going to do well or not, and in fact, in some ways, their ability to go out and buy a fairly large loss means they'd probably be inclined to go and buy one from the companies with the biggest losses. So I think this blind market issue is a real problem. I think the fact that the state is creating that market and running it as a state creates some real challenges. And so this idea of trying to get cash to early stage companies that need investment and it's hard to get investment is a great idea. I just don't know if this is the right one. And so I'll ask Mr. Mandel, again, I know we talked about this before, you know, would you be receptive to something that would require the company purchasing these losses to actually take an equity stake, maybe let's say half, if they're going to buy $10 million of operating losses, maybe half of that $5 million has got to be an equity stake in the company, so that we don't have this blind market and that the people buying these losses actually care about the future viability of the company whose losses they're buying. And that's a huge and distinct difference between what we do with the angel credit and these other credit bills that we have. The people utilizing those are 100% invested in the success of the entity they're investing in because their own equity is at risk. Here we don't have any of that. So is there any way for us to kind of get around this blind market issue and at least make sure the companies buying these losses care about the company whose losses they're acquiring and have an equity stake in them? Would that be a possibility?
Mr. Mandel?
You know, there's always a possibility, Representative Dunning, and we did chat about this. I think the, and again, you know, the focus of this bill from our perspective, and I don't think it's been specifically the focus of most of the questions that you all have raised, and so I do want to point a couple of those out, is about taking a uniquely situated group of companies and attempting to get them growth capital. So this is not the same thing as a restaurant or a big box store or a hardware store. I mean, capitalism is about those companies that perform best surviving and growing, and those that can't perform dying, and maybe it's because it's on the wrong corner street, and maybe it's because their product wasn't good or they priced too high or whatever. We're talking about companies that, because of the clinical requirements, and because we don't know everything about clinical studies today yet, and because of the FDA regulatory environment, in some ways this is Minnesota's attempt to take our industry that's unique and protect it from our own FDA today. So, if capitalism allows restaurants and hardware stores and big box stores to compete, some will live and some will die. If this industry goes away, none of us get new drugs. None of us get new devices, not in this country. That's the regulatory environment today. So this is largely an attempt to target those companies for survival, not because they're potentially bad businesses, but because they've got a plan, they're executing on it, and the game is being changed for them. So I think that's an important point to make. Mm-hmm. To your question specifically, Representative Downey, about the equity, it would be great, and I would love to see a scenario where our large companies, the Medtronic, St. Jude's, and Boston's, are more intertwined with our early-stage companies. What's good about the marketplace is it doesn't distinguish the buyer. Yes, there will be companies that will get a tax break, and you know that is not particularly palatable to us either, but it's the easiest and quickest way to put dollars on the table for the companies that need it. The equity issue, the problem is an equity investment, as you know, Representative Downey, is a contract. It's an investment. There are terms. Those terms take into account risk, ownership shares. So if we want to create that dynamic, are we now going to begin to dictate the terms? Who's going to assess the risk? Is Deed going to take a look at a company and say, well, this one's riskier, this one isn't, so ownership shares amount to this or they don't? Does Medtronic, St. Jude, or Best Buy want to move that into their portfolio? How strategic is that going to be? I mean, I think that the number of issues it creates, although the end outcome that I think you and I talked about that would be great is the goal, the issues that are created make the process so complicated, you know, because now you're talking about legal departments between two companies trying to negotiate an investment, and some of our big companies may not have an investment arm. So there's just a host of different issues that, you know, I think the objective is the right one. How we get there, I think, is pretty complicated. And certainly happy to have that conversation continually, but don't have a great answer today.
Representative Downey?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, maybe a separate idea. You mentioned a couple times that these are companies that are so close to being successful, and they got therapeutics and things that are in the FDA cycle. But I don't actually see that in the bill. It looks to me like anybody could sell a loss so long as they've been here 5 years and have 10 employees or whatever your criteria are. And so I'm wondering, is there any kind of a business plan test here? Would they have to substantiate that they are on a path to profitability? And having had some experience with early stage companies, you know, what happens is they get into this burn rate model and they have projections for markets opening up and approvals and all of these things and manufacturing coming online and all this stuff. And then all of a sudden the revenue doesn't materialize or they hit an FDA delay and they're stuck. They're out of cash and no, you know, they're not bankable. And we all get that. But at that point in time, everything else we do down here with tax credits puts the risk onto the person who'd make an investment into that company. And here we don't have any of that test. And so it seems to me we're actually rotating money to the least successful ventures out there, because they're the ones that will have the biggest losses and the biggest projection for losses and no profitability going forward. So could we at least put some kind of a business plan test in here to say that the companies that are selling these losses have to have some viable opportunity for profitability, so we don't just carry some failing companies for an extra year?
Mr. Mandel?
I think we can definitely play with the language. So, I mean, I think, Representative Downey, what you want and what these companies are, I mean, I think there's a way to do this that I think we can talk about, you know, and maybe the way to do it is, you know, looking at those companies that are pre-FDA approval, because, you know, one of the issues, and, you know, a couple of you have mentioned, you know, these sort of failing businesses, if I suggested they're so close to being in a market, you know, let's temper that just a bit and be realistic about, you know, these companies are all a little bit, here's what we're talking about. What we're talking about is a company that is in the development from, we got formed, and by the way, the business plan aspect has been validated, and whatever clinical or research work that has been done to date, whether it comes from the U or transfer out of another company, has been validated, because what we're talking about are companies, again, we're talking about companies with 50, 70 people and 50, 80, $100 million in investment. So I think the argument that angels and VCs that have expertise in this space making commitments under a pathway to regulatory approval and profitability is the validation. I would argue that, you know, I don't want to argue with people like Mike Berman and other experts that invest in these companies. If, you know, if they say it's a good bet, I think it's a good bet. What we're talking about here is the uncertainty, and there's no getting around this, the uncertainty of the final conclusions in a clinical setting and the amount of time it takes to get regulatory approval in this country. Over the last 3 to 4 years, the regulatory approval cycle at the FDA for similar products has increased, in some cases, by double. So, again, there is uncertainty in the approval process, and there's certainly uncertainty in the clinical environment where we're trying to come up with new therapies, new drugs, new devices. Some of them may not work and fail. And yes, you know, I think if you were able to look at this, if we put this law in place and it played out over a 10-year period of time, at the end of the day, what the state would have lost, to your point, Representative Downey, is the tax credits they extended to companies that ultimately weren't profitable, right? But for those companies that reinvested these dollars, created payroll taxes, sales taxes, ultimately made it to profitability and paid far more in tax as a profitable company than they would have previously under what they will get under this benefit. I think if you look at this over a 10-year period of time, the state of Minnesota is going to benefit fiscally as a state, but more importantly, we're going to keep this industry here, continue to add jobs, and we'll continue to be able to be the birthplace of some of the next great devices and therapies, which I think is important as well.
Representative Downey?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, just a final comment. And so thank you. I appreciate the energy and the ideas you're bringing, and we all share the interest in creating a dynamic investment climate here in Minnesota, and we kind of swim against the tide with a tax climate that just isn't the best for that, and so we're left with these kind of devices to try and figure out how to continue to fuel investment in Minnesota. And you raised a couple of interesting comments along the way that, you know, most of these places have a business plan that's validated. They've got $50 to $100 million in outside investment. Maybe they got 50 to 100 employees. And I don't see those criteria in the bill, so maybe that's something that we could work on in this idea of somehow finding a way to put a little skin in the game on the people who are buying these credits or these losses to make sure that they're actually buying losses from companies that are viable as compared to those that aren't. Maybe we could get a little closer for me. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Downey. Representative Erickson.
Mr. Chair, I'll pass because I think Representative Downey did ask much of what I was going to ask.
Thank you, Representative Erickson. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Mandel. You know, I just don't see, I agree with Representative Lincheski that this would probably be in the deed committee and the deed budget rather than out of our tax policy. But I agree with Representative Downey. The criteria here are just so minimal. And we, you know, on both the seller side with the losses, the company that's going to go under because it's not making any money and nobody wants to put any money in it because They just don't have faith for whatever reason. And, you know, they only have to have one employee working 35 hours a week in Minnesota. They can have up to 250, so they can have 249 in a competing state, Ohio or anywhere else in the state of Minnesota or in the United States or maybe even offshore. But all they have to do is have one person here. Then, and there's no requirement that future growth happen within our state. The buyers of the losses, that company isn't has any restrictions on it. So the buyer of those losses can be in any industry. They can be anywhere that there's a profitable company. And it may not be a company that has any interest in the Minnesota economy. All they need is losses to offset tax liability. And it just feels to me like the public benefit here is pretty limited. And if I were that new biotech inventor with my newly minted PhD and I thought I saw something in the laboratory that had some promise and so I've now incorporated and you know I've run through the initial money, I get, this is the best of all worlds because I get to sell something that has almost no value to me and a present value, my losses, and I don't have any obligation to the person who's financing me. Where in a typical relationship you have an obligation to repay the loan or to, you know, share the wealth. If you're outrageously successful after selling your losses, all that profit and all that control is yours. And you have no obligation to even stay, you know, long-term and develop jobs here in Minnesota. And so, I mean, I do think, you know, it just doesn't have enough of a payback and a connection here. And if it was an appropriation and a grant funding program for emerging businesses, it would go through some, you know, legitimate assessment of all those things. But I am real concerned about the minimal connection to Minnesota. One out of 250 employees, I could see an office building in downtown. You'd have lots of people making very little money, but it would create the nexus so you could sell your losses from Tennessee or Texas or Ohio or wherever in Minnesota, and we would really reap nothing as a state. And how are we going to avoid that kind of abuse of what I don't think is at all your intent, but I don't think there's any safeguards to prevent it.
Okay, Representative Marquardt, and then we will wrap up with the
Marquardt. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I, Representative Downey, the very criticisms you had for this bill today were the exact criticisms I had for the Capco bill. No equity is required by the Capco. No risk is required by the Capco. There are no incentives or requirements for the Capcos to invest in the type of companies we really want them to invest in. There's no requirement for a business plan to create new jobs. So all of those things you said, I thought we were hearing about the Capco. I thought it was me actually talking on the other side when I heard you today. So I found that interesting. And I will, for the record, I actually put this program higher, in my humble opinion, than the Capco one, if you can believe that, Mr. Chair.
And with that, members, thank you for your work today. Thank you, Representative Mazerol. Thank you, Mr. Mandel. We will just lay this bill over at this point. Good government all the time. We're adjourned.